I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this February 12th Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick talks with Tom Papinski on the rise of authoritarianism. Tom Papinski is an associate professor in the government department at Cornell University. In the second of a two-part interview, Desiree Helgers interviews the legendary Northwest singer, songwriter, and activist Jim Page. They talk about gentrification, justice, songwriting, and resistance. And The Left and the Law with Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker discuss the moral necessity defense and how it has been used in civil disobedience cases, including in recent climate justice actions. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole, and we want to thank people for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting KBOO and programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour. And now we'll turn to Bill Resnick and Tom Papinski.
Hi, Tom Papinski. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Tom Papinski teaches politics at Cornell. He writes a great deal. His specialty is the rise of authoritarianism, which he first studied in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, Thailand, the Philippines. And then he generalized to examine it across the globe. So, Tom, your choice to study authoritarianism turned out to be very prescient. When you started, establishment political science still accepted the idea that, and pretty much all of social science somehow were gulled into thinking that history has ended, that democratic capitalism has triumphed. Because it was so productive, it spread the wealth and comfort to the whole population, surely not equally, but still vastly improved the lives of the great majority. And that every country would somehow be pressed, would have to adopt democratic capitalism in order to attract investment and maintain popular support. Today, though, history has not just ended, it's really returned in a very menacing way, because we surely see capitalism solidifying its already dominant power across the globe, but not bringing democratic gains. In fact, the opposite. What we see today is the global rise of authoritarian movements and parties, like in Europe, that have only won a few elections but are menacing in almost every country. So, Tom, what happened to the end of history, to the triumph of democratic capitalism, and why did it happen?
Well, you're only asking the single most important question of our time, and I won't pretend to have a definitive or singular answer to it, but I can give you some thoughts that I think might be interesting to reflect upon. The first thing I'd say is it's actually been about the past 15 years that political scientists have been asking this question about whether or not we should accept the finality of democratic government as the final state to which all countries are developing. Now, we had known for a long time that you can just look across time at any index of democracy or freedom or civil liberties that you want to find, and there's a steady increase over time. And that's true, but it masks a whole lot of difference, a whole lot of variation. And starting around the early 2000s, political scientists started to say, well, what is this thing, what is this type of regime that has elections, and maybe it even has more than one party, but it's not getting any more liberal, it's not getting any more free, it's not getting any more competitive. And starting, as I said, about 15 years ago, people started using a term called competitive authoritarianism, which is a term that reflects a particular type of political system in which elections do exist, they're regularly held, and they're not even necessarily uncompetitive. But the structure of political competition is so unevenly tilted towards the incumbent government, towards the regime, that competition and regime change is really impossible. And so starting around, like I said, the 2000s, you had people studying countries like Malaysia, you had people studying countries like Russia under Putin, you had people studying countries like Venezuela, people studying countries like Mexico prior to the democratization in the late 1990s. And we developed actually a fairly sophisticated understanding of these types of regimes. But what was really surprising is that nobody really thought that could possibly apply to the United States. Nobody had really thought that these were types of regimes that would emerge out of what are otherwise quite competitive democratic regimes. Rather, they had been seen as kind of a stalled or incomplete transition that had become stable and solidified. So we have the tools, but now we need to be looking in different places for how to apply them.
In fact, now in the United States, you see that same pattern in its sort of infancy, and that is the effort to, not an attack on electoralism, but a effort to take control of the electoral process, like voter suppression and all of those things seem to be early. But Trump is also dangerous in other ways, it seems to me.
I think that's right. I think you've diagnosed first one mechanism that is commonly found across the world. When you wish to tilt elections in favor of the incumbent regime, you do everything that you can to ensure that you control who votes. That's not new in the United States. We have to remember that. That's been a history that's been long part of how American politics works. But I think that the presumption that the president led with during the campaign, that if he lost, that would itself be evidence that something had gone wrong, that there was an improper type of voting, is novel and dangerous.
Yeah, tell us why.
Well, because what that means is that it's impossible to demonstrate that the election has been conducted fairly if the evidence that you use is the outcome. Rather, he's not very interested. He wasn't very interested in naming or investigating specific examples, because had he done so, the evidence suggests that there's not a lot of, say, electoral fraud or immigrants voting or what have you. Rather, the tone was that the election itself could only be valid if the outcome was what he had anticipated.
Yeah. Many of the dictators then who annul an election that way, and the military supports them, and that's basically the end of even any possibilities of the democratic experiment.
I think that's right. You know, it's interesting, though, the thing to remember is it doesn't have to be the military who does this. It often is. It sometimes can be. But if the people themselves, if a substantial number of people are unwilling to respect the outcome of an election because they don't like it, or they tend to give credence to one side over the other as having greater authority to define what legitimacy is, then the military can stay in the barracks and the outcome can be the same.
Well, sometimes they also do it through the courts, right? You pack the courts. And in fact, we saw an early evidence of that sort of mild. The Supreme Court basically decided to end the election of the Bush-Gore election and declare Bush the president based on the fear of disorder if the American people thought that the uncertainty of the election would drive them to some kind of psychic breakdown. It was all preposterous. It had nothing to do with the law. The law that they used was, I'm an old lawyer, was never used in that way. In fact, it's been limited in every conceivable way. Suddenly they dragged out this idea and just seated Bush. When they got away with that, it seems to me that that strengthened the whole process of de-democratization.
Well, what's interesting about that is that that had the effect on you and me that Trump's rhetoric prior to the election had on many of his supporters, which is that it leads us to believe that the institutions and procedures of democratic governance cannot be trusted in and of themselves. This is a symmetrical argument. If either side, if you imagine politics as, to simplify, a struggle between a left and a right, or a populist and an elite, or whatever have you, if either side, it doesn't require just one, if either side loses faith in the process, then there's no reason to ask for that process or to vest in that process the authority to allocate political power. And that's all democracy is a procedure to allocate political power. It's a procedure that has, for me, some nice properties, some things that I think are valuable, but it's not a panacea. So if people think they'd rather fight over substantive politics than trust in the procedures, then the trust in the system is undermined. And it's hard to imagine going back.
Yeah, on the other hand, you could make that argument about almost any abuse of power within the state. It's all used by the authoritarians to say government can't be trusted. On the other hand, if some of the agencies, like a lot of the agencies of the Interior Department, are in fact making decisions, or the Agriculture Department, that are racist towards Native Americans or blacks, or giving great benefits to, let's say, the oil companies, which they've done over the years, and especially towards Native American oil revenues, it seems to me that one has to challenge those things and not sort of argue, well, government requires faith in government, and therefore we don't want these scandals to be ended.
I agree with you, but this is a dilemma that we face, and there's no easy or simple answer to how do you decide what is too much of a violation of a norm or principle to be acceptable. But it's clear to me that progressives make a choice about what are the hills upon which they're willing to die and what are the hills upon which they're willing to say we lost this election and we lost this policy battle and we're going to return and follow the procedures that we wish to follow in order to win in the next one. Remember, the mid-2000s were a time of catastrophic thinking for progressives, just catastrophic thinking for progressives. And that lack of faith or trust in American institutions, the most consequential thing that could have happened to restore that faith was just the victory of their own candidate in 2008. And so that's the terms upon which I think progressives need to be thinking.
This is KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour talking to Tom Pepinski, who studies authoritarianism. We've been discussing the roots of it and the many dilemmas of maintaining democratic government. Let's talk about, Tom, now another dilemma of democratic government that it seems to me is also goes very, very deep, which is the disenfranchisement of most people in politics because of a variety of factors, one of which is in daily life, the issues have become so complex and people spend so little time in actually democratic structures, and particularly at work, which are extremely authoritarian, and in fact the work has been de-skilled, so it becomes more authoritarian. And then unions are being destroyed, which means there's even less democratic participation in thinking about work. It seems to me we're creating a society where most people are not asked through the structures of life to actually engage in thinking about the larger society and what kind of society they want. I think there's more democracy, though, in social life. Feminism has made it possible for women to become citizens and to fight back, as well as the civil rights movement, of course, which triggered everything. There are things that most people do most of the time, which is the workplace. It's become more dominated from the top, and people have much less room, especially now where everybody's afraid for their job, for people actually to think about it and to actually democratically participate in those crucial decisions.
That's an interesting description of our current condition, and I must confess I want to sit and think about this for a little bit. I want to maybe talk you through how I think about that. I certainly agree that under conditions of economic uncertainty and hardship, people are mindful of speaking up or organizing in ways that might threaten their employment. What I'd like to know, and I don't know, is how that has changed from the perspective of the individual worker, the individual employee, over time. I don't look romantically on the past in America or in the other advanced industrial economies at times where workers were involved in great moments of democratic politics that didn't involve anything other than hard work and struggle. And so I don't think that there's been a change in the conditions of employment. I don't know if there's been a change in the conditions of employment right now. I do believe that the union movement has been greatly hobbled by regulations that limit its ability to organize in certain states, by deindustrialization, by technological change, and by other factors as well.
And by capital mobility, they just tell workforces, if you vote for a union or if you go on strike, we're out of here. That's a real threat, and everybody knows it.
Right. But again, my point is that that's not new. That's always been the argument that the employer or the boss.
Right. But now they really can't do it, and the factories are shuttered all in every Rust Belt city, so...
Right.
It's not an empty threat.
I don't think it is an empty threat. I think you can see the march of manufacturing employment from, say, upstate New York to South Carolina and Tennessee. And I think that will demonstrate that quite simply and quite powerfully. But there's more than just that at play, and I don't think this is a new development. The weight of this problem and its consequences for American labor, I think, are interesting in that I don't think that many of those who have suffered from deindustrialization and the collapse of the manufacturing sector believe that the Democratic Party has within it a plan to rescue their jobs.
Or to put them in a secure position where they can lead a life and look forward to the future and educate their kids.
I think that remains the case that the Democratic Party is going to have to make. And it also remains the case that even the Democratic Party's progressive challengers on the left will need to make as well.
Tom Papinski, thanks a lot for talking to us. But we have to talk again on the question of authoritarians capitalizing on fear and disorder. And in a lot of work, and I think yours too, you take the position that the fear and disorder is sort of personalized against other people or immigrants or the rest, and that's real, and that they've succeeded in doing that, like Trump. I wonder, though, if in fact there's a deeper cause of people's worries and anxieties, but that they can't express it because it's dangerous to think about it that way. We have to understand that their authoritarian rise based in threats to their economic well-being and the tremendous precariousness of most people now. There are no settled jobs and no settled lives nearly everywhere, including in agriculture, where industrial agriculture forcing people off the land everywhere. Anyway, why don't you just reply to that and then we'll sign off.
I think that a classic tool of the aspiring authoritarian is to argue that there's something menacing and wrong in society, and that menacing thing can have many number of different names. It can be illegal immigrants who, quote, don't belong here, unquote, or it can be drug abusers, which is common in Southeast Asia, or homosexuals, something also common in Southeast Asia, to argue that this is some sort of latent threat that exists, or it could be sometimes argued that perhaps a religious minority or a communist movement. Whatever it is, the idea is named a threat which exists and is kind of like a cancer on society. And aspiring authoritarians make this argument on the presumption that voters will respond by saying that they are willing to sacrifice some of their liberties or some of their rights for the purpose of containing that threat. I think that the far more insidious process in the United States is not the mobilization of those in the working classes who have been dispossessed or disenfranchised or made uncertain and precarious through the change in the economy, but rather the mobilization of the middle classes around a presumed threat that is even sometimes hard for them to see, but they can fear it anyway, that there is a movement of black people or immigrants or Muslims or some other identity group within American politics that needs to just be eliminated.
Yeah, I think you're right in that. But it changes the appeals to working people, do change the voting patterns a little bit of the bottom half sufficiently to win elections. That would be my reply. But it was really good talking to you. Thanks a lot. We'll talk again.
You're welcome. Thanks for taking the time. This was fun. I appreciate it.
Right. So long.
Also later on The Old Mole, we'll hear from The Left and the Law with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, who will discuss the moral necessity defense and how it has been used in civil disobedience cases, including in recent climate justice actions. Next up, in the second of a two-part interview, Desiree Helligers interviews the legendary Northwest singer, songwriter, and activist Jim Page. They'll talk about gentrification, justice, songwriting, and resistance.
Seattle is a Garden of Eden. It's a paradise, that's what they say. But believe it or not, you'll be living in a parking lot if you can't make it pay. Now the mayor's a liberal, and the council is mixed, and there's a socialist riding on board. And they raised up the minimum to 15 an hour. That's the least that the boss could afford. Still, you're sleeping on a cardboard mattress. And your house on the hill is a tent. And they could freeze all the prices right now. But you still couldn't pay for the rent. Now, some people tell me there's nothing you can do about it. It's just human nature, they claim. This is the greatest system in the world. It just needs a little lube on the chain. Well, me, I got a better idea. I say let's shut it all down. Let's defang the bankers and sink all the tankers and spread all the money around. 'Cause Seattle is a Garden of Eden. It's a paradise at the end of its line. So let's put it out with the curbside recycling and try to do better next time.
I can't help in hearing that song but think of Didn't We Shut It Down, right? Your song about the WTO protest.
Yeah, well, that was the thing about, you know, they were going to come and shut down the meetings. It's only a song, so you can get kind of overboard. But if you notice, I say let's shut it all down, then I say let's put it out with the curbside recycling. I didn't say put it out in the trash. Recycling is where you put things in. Supposedly, it goes away somewhere where people take it apart and they put it into something better and bring it out. So that's basically what the song is saying.
Yeah, so where do you find hope? I mean, you've been watching these trends. You've been watching it all happen for...
I don't use that word. I don't like that word. It sounds like you're hoping that things will change instead of doing something. You're hoping that someone will come along and make it better. It's almost a religious term. It's like you're hoping the Savior will come before too long. You see, we have to get past that. Hope is where the oppressed people sit down and wait to be saved. That's hope. We don't have hope. We have plans. We have parties. We have organizations. We have committees. We talk. We meet. We get together. We do things. We do actions. Hope is when you're not doing anything. This morning in The Guardian, there was a story about him. He had known about it for a couple of days, but I just read about it this morning. A guy in, Arizona, somewhere like that. He's part of an organization called, I think, No More Deaths. Mm-hmm. And it's concerning the migrants coming up from Mexico who die. And this guy's being charged with the horrendous crime of humanitarian aid to people who are walking through the desert. He goes out there, him and his friends go out there with water, and they leave water in certain places. They leave it so the migrants will find it. I have friends down there that do the same thing. And they told me when I was down there last year that they will come out to check on the water that they left and find bullet holes in it. So all the water leaked out. Somebody shot it. So the inspiration, not the hope, but the inspiration is that these people go out there and they do that. And this guy goes out there and he does, and he's facing 6 years, but he goes ahead anyway. That's inspiring. You know, hope, smoke, go out and do something. Get inspired by people like that.
You wrote a song about kind of fear in the era of Trump, didn't you?
I wrote 4 Trump songs.
Okay.
One before he even got elected. I always want to say arrested. Then I wrote one before the inauguration, and then I wrote one after the inauguration, and then I wrote one when I went in and made that record that I gave you for that. I basically rewrote Masters of War. I called it Masters of Lies.
Yeah.
Again, different melody, different words, just kind of spins off the idea, and there's references to the idea in there.
Yeah.
I want to put this one down. Coming into my town, what you talking about? Coming into my town, I'm gonna run you out. Coming into my town, what you talking about? Coming into my town, I'm gonna run you out. You're a proud boy, you're a 3%, you're a virus looking for an incident. You're coming into my town, I'm gonna run you out. You're an alt-right, you're a bright Bart, you're dead and looking for a place to start. You're coming into my town, I'm gonna run you out. You're coming into my town, what you talking about? You're coming into my town, I'm gonna run you out. You're coming into my town, what you talking about? You're coming into my town, I'm gonna run you out.
You're a white supreme, you're a KKK, living under a rock, you ought to stay that way. You're coming into my town, I'm gonna run you out. You're a Nazi, you got a Nazi flag, you carry your brains in an air sick bag. Coming into my town, I'm gonna run you out. You're coming into my town, what you talking about? You're coming into my town, I'm gonna run you out. You're coming into my town, what you talking about? You're coming into my town, I'm gonna run you out. I know you're thinking that you got it made. You got the idiot president marching in your big parade. Yeah, but he's a blowhard, just like you. So bring him along, we'll do him too. You're coming into my town, I'm gonna run you out. That's like that. There's a whole lot of pissed off people coming around the bend. Yeah, we did it before, we're gonna do it again. Cause we're Americans, we got a short fuse, and all you fascists bound to lose. You're coming into my town, I'm gonna run you out. You're coming into my town, I'm gonna run you out. You're coming into my town, I'm gonna run you out.
All right, well, that is a powerful one, isn't it? Can we go back to busking for a minute?
Yes,
and talk about busking?
Whatever you want.
Because I feel like, you know, what you're saying is that this, you know, busking, writing music, singing has this incredible immediacy, right?
Yeah.
You don't have to wait years for it to get published and come out. It's a form that's ready to address every crisis as it's unfolding. But the criminalization of musicians in public spaces is one way to kind of shut that out. And gentrification brings its own forms of criminalizing people who are gathering in public spaces, right?
Right.
So last summer, I think you did a series of songwriting events in the parks, right?
Mm-hmm.
In 2016, at least, in Seattle, right?
Yeah.
So it seems like you're looking for other ways to kind of open up new public spaces in Seattle.
Well, yeah. We have all these little parks. They're called pocket parks. Some are about as big as a studio, you know, just a little vacant lot or something. The ones that we did those in were larger. They were actual, you know, like a half a block or something. But use them. Use them. I mean, there's a program in Seattle where they pay buskers to go in and play music in little parks where homeless people hang out. The idea being to drive them out. Okay? Yeah.
To drive them out.
Yeah.
Using music to drive people out.
Well, yeah, because it'll like upscale it rather than downscale it. It's that sort of. I mean, they've actually even pretty much said that. It has to do with the drinking, public drinking, intoxication. Maybe some drugs are involved, blah, 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 blah.
So music as an instrument of gentrification.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Music as a weapon.
And I thought, yeah, for the wrong side. My thought was to create this little adventure. People come, and some of them were really cool, man. Everybody brought an instrument. There were kids with little instruments and so on, and people had songs, and we opened them up, you know, and let's sing songs, and I'm going to teach you these songs, well, this, we're going to do that, you know, and I'll teach you one of mine, and we'll do these songs, and we all got together, and we all sang. And that's nice to just kind of do and then leave, but the idea would be to keep it going. Anyway, that was...
And these are sing-alongs, right? So
yeah, I mean, I thought it would be really cool to have people gather, and, you know, if you can just get the idea in people's heads that you don't have to be a master... You don't have to have a good vocabulary. You don't have to be able to carry a tune. Just write what you see, what happened to you. Write what's going on in your neighbor. Write what your neighbors are doing. Write what your kids are doing. Write what your kids tell you when they come home from school. Write those things. Sing them. That's what counts. That's the stuff that counts. Go out and sing them. You know, and if we'd all like gather in those little public spaces, because if you don't gather in the public spaces, it's easier for them to take the public space away, you know? Whereas if you're there all the time, you know, it's like legalizing busking after all this time in Seattle, it would be hard for them to say, okay, enough is enough, we're done with this, your people are all going to get arrested or something. That'd be really hard to pull off. So if we start using those for something other than just staring into space or whatever people do, you know, singing them, like Washington Square Park in the 60s, Greenwich Village, you know. All those people would hang out there, Pete Seeger and stuff, and they'd all go sing those songs, all different kinds of songs, you know, every Sunday. They started out really small, then they got really big, and we need to do that. The music of today, the songs of today, the events of today, we need to be public with them amongst ourselves. and stop worrying about attracting somebody with money or a big cigar or a contract or anything like that. You know, leave them do their thing. This is for us. We need to do this for ourselves. We go do this. You know, we can build a culture.
You've written a lot of songs about poverty and a lot of songs about war, and I'm guessing that you're also recognizing how much of the domestic scene and people's quality of life and just ability to not die on the street is mm-hmm. related to that endless U.S. militarism.
Yeah, yeah. No, it is. It really is. It's frustrating to run into, you know, hate to bring the conversation this direction, but the classic kind of liberal thing, you know, of wanting capitalism to be nice, you know, and it's, we do have a standard of living that depends on somebody else's trouble. You know, somebody has to be hollowed out for us to have all this stuff. We've been doing it for years. It's how the place was founded, for God's sake. You know, it was founded on war. It was founded on war. It expanded on war. It gained territory on war. It's been at war since the beginning. You know, our national anthem is a war song. You know, the State Department used to be the War Department. All this stuff. The Bureau of Indian Affairs used to be in the war. Think about that one for a while. You know, it's a trip. It's a trip. And we need
it's more
to
honest to call it the War Department, though, right?
It is, yeah.
Defense Department.
Yeah, rather than Defense Department, yeah. But yeah, no, I think about these things and I sing about them to the best of my ability, but I don't want to sing handbills. I don't want to sing speeches. I want to sing songs. Okay, my example, my model is The Midnight Special, which is a song that pretty much everybody knows. Okay, it's a perfect song. Completely perfect. It's got four verses that I know of anyway. Each one is a little story into itself. It's written beautifully, very human. It's got a class consciousness to it. You know, it's got the woman going to see the governor with a piece of paper to try to get her husband out of jail. You know, it's got the guys in jail there being careful what they say or they won't get fed. You know, it goes through all this stuff. And then the last verse is, if you ever go to Houston, you better walk right or that cop will arrest you. And it'll take you down and you can bet your bottom dollar your penitentiary bound. That's a warning written by somebody who knew. And they could probably tell you the guy's name, but it's not in the song. You know, the cop that would arrest you. It's a perfect song. And the chorus is, Let the Midnight Special shine its ever-loving light on me. You know, now if you don't know anything, like I didn't know anything when I first heard it. I learned it and I sang it. I didn't know anything about it. I just thought it was kind of not really a nonsense song, but just kind of there was something really cool about it. It had some good feel to it. You know, shine its ever-loving light on me. I thought maybe that was like a spiritual thing or something. I don't know what. Then I found out it's a penitentiary song, and that the mythology was that there was a train that went by every night, long around midnight, roughly speaking. They called it a midnight special, and the mythology was that if the light from that train shone on you, you would be paroled soon. Now the song gets even more interesting, but my point is, it's a good song before you know it, and it's a good song after you know it. It's just a good song. But it's only really good because it has reality in it. You can sing it without knowing the reality. You can hear it without knowing the reality. And it's still good. But that's the test. The test of an insider song is, will an outsider get off on it? You know? And if they don't, back to the drawing board.
Well, your music is infused with resistance. So I guess that's the part that's not just hope, right?
Yes.
It's resist, right?
Yes.
It's resistant. Yeah, I mean, so your music has had an impact on so many, such a strong impact on the Northwest music scene, including, you know, Portland's own Dave Rovick. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Dave is real good. I met him in Seattle at a bar called Murphy's that I was playing in. A mutual acquaintance brought him down. And at that time, he had hair down to his knees, practically. And he was doing, you know, he was doing Billy Bragg songs or whatever the song. He was doing all kinds of punk songs and stuff and folk songs. And I think he learned a couple of mine in there. But I remember when he was saying he couldn't write. He didn't have a thing to say. You know, I don't know what I'm going to do. Maybe I've got to go back and get a, you know, be a barista again. Because, you know, he's done that. You know, everybody's done. It's the modern bartending, right? And then before you know it, he's writing like a song a day. A song a week, whatever it is, you know.
Yeah, he's pretty prolific.
He's very prolific. Yeah. And he told me or told other people or wrote it on his blog or something. Can't remember exactly. I think he wrote it. That there's no mystery of songwriting. Just start. Just keep doing it and you'll get better. And he's right. He's completely right. And he's written some magnificent songs. You know, and he learned how to do it by doing it. So if you want to write songs, just do it. Don't let anybody tell you you can't. Okay?
Nice.
Just do it. Don't ever let anybody... That's the thing about busking. Don't ever let anybody tell you you can't sing, play, and write. You can. You can do all of those things, and you can go out and you can sing right now. You know? And if people laugh at you, that's their problem.
And the cop told you you couldn't, and you took it to City Hall.
Exactly. But, you know, the indie scene is very healthy. The music scene is great. There are great people singing, great people playing. Don't let anybody ever say, where are all the protest songs gone? Just tell them to listen. James, go to the club. Listen to a busker. Walk around. Turn on the... They're all over the place. People are singing all over the place.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for taking the time to come into the studio and talk with me today. And I'm so sorry to tell our audience, right, that you will already be gone from town by the time that this interview airs. But if people want to know, people, you know, who are unaware of how to catch your shows and get more information, jimpage.net, is that where they should
go? Jimpage.net, right. And I have a new CD out, and so you can... There's places you can download it. You can contact me. I can send you one. It'll probably be up in CD Baby before too long.
You've been listening to the second half of a two-part interview with the legendary Northwest singer-songwriter-activist Jim Page. This has been Desiree Helligers with the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBU Radio, KBOO Portland. That's 90.7 listener-supported community radio. Well, next up, we have The Left and the Law with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, and they are here to discuss the moral necessity defense. Mike and Jan?
Well, in October 2016, five activists with the moniker The Valve Turners briefly shut down 15% of America's oil supply by cutting pipes along the U.S.-Canadian border. Their action was to call attention to climate change. The Valve Turners called the pipeline companies to alert them, live-streamed shutoffs, and peacefully awaited their arrests in Minnesota, Washington, North Dakota, and Montana before shutting off the valves. There have been a number of trials and hearings of cases against the activists in the four states, and several trials are underway. A judge in Minnesota made the historically unprecedented move to allow defendants to use the necessity clause to argue that their action is a reasonable response to addressing climate change. So, Mike, let's talk about the necessity defense a bit on the history and how to meet the bar, which is very high in legal situations, and also it has a pretty scattered history in terms of activism.
It's a pretty glorious history, actually. It was used in the early 18th century by Peter Zenger, who deliberately published something that was against the law and got a jury verdict of innocence, not despite the fact that it was clearly against the law at the time. And it led pretty directly to the First Amendment and the freedom of the press. And John Brown used a defense against the charges of having killed and initiated this big military attack in Harper's Ferry, Virginia, by pleading the elements of what today is a necessity defense, saying everything else had been tried. Slavery had been approached with, legislators had been approached with petitions, one of them a series of signatures, a third of a mile long against it. Everything shy of bloodshed had been tried. And more recently in the Vietnam War and then again in the 1980s, people, for example, in 1987, in an attack against the Contras in Nicaragua and the CIA, There was people were charged with disorderly conduct and trespass during a demonstration against the CIA. They put on evidence. Witnesses described assassinations, murders, campaigns of misinformation, and ultimately all defendants were acquitted.
Now, part of the strategy of the necessity defense is to acknowledge guilt. There's not a dispute about what you've done, but the reasoning behind it and the likelihood that your action will result in something defensible. How can you explain how you acknowledge and admit guilt on one level, but also push for a jury trial, because the jury trial is where the real drama is and where arguments can be made that have political play?
Well, in 1987, the defendants didn't deny that they committed trespass and they were disorderly by the standards, but they said there's essentially no other way. There's a real necessity to do this. And
would that then be taken into account in sentencing, or can you?
No, it's a defense. Like you plead manslaughter, you plead self-defense. True, I admit I shot and killed this person, but they were coming straight at me and they had a big knife, and therefore I'm excused.
So it's not with the insanity plea or many pleas, it's to avoid a jury trial.
Well, these people want
but
a jury
with this,
trial.
Right. So the strategy has to involve some refusal to accept some of the charges. Is that correct?
Well, they don't accept, they don't deny committing the acts. Like the valve turners did indeed cut the pipes, but they say it was justified. Like my
innocent
murder,
by reason of morality and necessity.
Well, or just pure self-preservation. It's not strictly a moral issue. It has to do with preservation, for example, of the planet. That's what the valve turners are arguing.
Now, one of the examples from the right-wing use of this has been the abortion threats of murdering doctors and what was called the Nuremberg strategy, that these are abortion doctors are committing a genocide, and so to kill them serves this larger good. In this case, though, these were threats or actual murder of people. It seems that there is always this question of the harms committed. And here, I know with the valve turners, there was quite an effort to warn, to make sure no one was harmed, to warn the companies that they were going to be turning off the valves. How important is that in the use of the necessity defense, that you've been very attentive to not harming people?
Well, of course, it improves your odds. And I think it's appropriate for climate issues. They're trying desperately to get past the judges and to get to a jury. The judges essentially don't like jurors. They regard jury trials as a way of slowing down their calendar as the general pain. But if you can...
Probably some truth to that, but...
Yeah, it's not efficient at all. It never has been. But the only way you can get a real sort of conflict with people's lives on the line is to have a jury trial and have people show up and talk about it and have a jury verdict. And you can lose big. That's what makes it interesting. And you can also win if you prevail. Then that's an outcome that reverberates, as trials did during the Vietnam War. There were trials of people for protesting who undisputedly violated laws about private property and destruction of this and that, but they were nonetheless found innocent in trials in Florida, and these had an impact. They reflected a truth that people were generally tired of the war, did not like the war, and it was a way of making that crystal clear. Beyond any sort of propaganda from either side, this is what the people think about these actions. So,
and that the valve turners themselves have talked about the daunting legal challenges and the elaborate legal side of the reasoning involved, but have also pointed out that at the end of the day, there is this way in which you're talking about persuading people of your cause. And so, and I think the fact that it has fared so differently in different states suggests that people are, it's not just a matter of working through the requirements of the law, but whether people think, you know, this is, there's something here that's important going on.
Right. And they wisely spread their bets. They made four actions in four states. Some of the people are going to suffer. Some of the people are going to do real time, spend maybe more than a year in jail. Others, like in Minnesota, they're going to actually succeed in getting a trial and calling witnesses, calling people like Jim Hansen and, well, you know, William McKibben, some of the most famous China, you know, climate activists alive will appear, and they'll be able to try to put some flesh on the bones of this relatively abstract climate change argument. And show how it's not really abstract. It has concrete effects now and in the future. You know, the problem is showing that there's imminent danger. John Brown could say, every day that we wait, the slaves are being lashed, blood, and being killed.
So what about the race and class aspects of this taking these kinds of risks? Because the valve turners themselves acknowledge there are people in their 50s and 60s. They said, you know, older people have less risk serving time in jail or prison. They're all white, and so there are certain privileges, and the law tends to be harsher with minority groups. Look at the comparisons with Standing Rock protesters. What about the high risks that are attached to these actions of civil disobedience and their place in movement work?
There are real risks. It's true. People who are older white people tend to be more leniently treated, but they can certainly be retaliated against precisely because they're, you know, forfeiting their privileges. That has happened. It's so odd on this issue how white men and fossil fuels are becoming conflated by Donald Trump, who embodies strong support for both. But it's true. In doing any action at all, and it has always been true, the people who are older know the risks better and have much less to lose than a young person. A young person is a bigger gamble. It can be a narrow road into heroism, but can also be a wider road into serious lifetime devolution.
And being labeled a felon.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are the legal criteria for the necessity defense? Could you just briefly say, without getting into all the minutiae of the law, like what do these cases have to argue?
Well, it varies from state to state. There, you know, everyone acknowledges some form of necessity defense. Like if you break the speed limit while driving to a hospital because you've got somebody in your car who's bleeding and in danger of death, it's okay. There's a good reason for that.
And the classic example of shoving someone out from a train. We're talking here about less immediate contingencies, and the more remote the influence or threat, the higher the bar, right?
Yeah, well, you've got to show that there's a serious danger, and some states say it's got to be imminent. Most states do not. You know, that's a controversial requirement, but how imminent, what does imminent mean? Next, you've got to show that you have tried everything else, that there's no legal alternatives. You've tried petitions and other measures, and some areas, some courts require you to say there's no public policy against it, but it's a statewide variance. But there's getting past that hurdle and the judge to a jury is the hard part.
And the advantages of having a jury trial are attached to disadvantages. I mean, juries are manipulated and often emotions prevail.
But Jan, you can present witnesses. You can cross-examine the state.
On the other hand, there is something about rationality and evidence that prevails in the courts. That These cases are riveting in that way, that people really have to have their act together and have a way of arguing, even though it does rely on emotion.
It's not an abstract dissertation, a jury trial.
Yeah, and with so much at stake, there is an element of political theater, but it's compelling, and with so much of media being dominated by the most the poorest kind of performance of politics, there is still something about these courtroom scenes and getting a jury trial that's worth fighting for.
Exactly.
So we'll continue to follow the valve turners. It's unfolding in ways that are fascinating, and you know, some victories here and there, some losses, but they're an incredible group of people. And on our website, we have the valve turners website, and where you can follow the legal events, and we will continue to follow their work in solidarity, and I know they are also raising money to continue their struggle, even with pro bono legal lawyers helping. There are all kinds of costs.
It's very expensive, very demanding.
Going. Okay, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the necessity defense and the valve turners cases.
Thank you, Jan and Mike, as always. Jan and Mike, The Left and the Law, a unique program on our community radio, and it's something that we feature at least a couple times a month. Yeah. Retirement suits you both very well. We hear a lot from you. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. We want to thank our participants this morning, first starting with our engineer, Patricia Kohlberg. As always, a fantastic job back there. Thank you. Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker with The Left and the Law. We had Bill Resnick, our founding mole, talking with Tom Papinski about the rise of authoritarianism, and Desiree Helgers talking to Jim Page about gentrification, justice, songwriting, and resistance. You can find that all on the Old Mole Variety Hour page on kboo.fm. I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.